This week in Retronauts, we redefine the meaning of the word greatest. Hi, everyone. Welcome to Retronauts, episode 760 by my notes. This is a sequel to episode 754. That was a month ago, 4 weeks to be precise. We record a lot and publish a lot in a month, but sometimes we look back, and in this case, we're looking back at an episode from 4 weeks ago and saying, you know what? We weighed in with our opinions, but maybe we're not the only ones who have opinions. Maybe other opinions should be heard. Some of us strenuously disagree, but they're here nevertheless. So thank you, gentlemen, for returning to this episode and being so game for talking about games. Please introduce yourself, starting with, let's say, Stuart.
Hi,
I gave it away.
I'm Stuart Jupp, you know. You know.
Right. Did I introduce myself? I can never remember if I do that.
I don't think so, but I think that I don't think there's anyone who's listening to this who doesn't know who you are, because you're very
famous. They might. I'm your mystery host. You don't know who I am. But
our other man.
I wanted it to be a surprise for the end of the show. All right, and who else is here with us?
I'm Kurt Coletta. I was here last time.
Oh, hey. Yes, it's like a reprise.
Yeah.
A reprieve or something. Anyway, yeah, so last month we published an episode called The Greatest 8-Bit Licensed Games of All Time.
I'm so nostalgic for
and, that. And yeah, I know. Remember those the olden days when we published that episode? It was great. Man. Now, we kind of strayed from the original intent of that episode's topic, and that's okay, because what is Retronauts if not kind of chaotic and unpredictable? So to really, really open up the gates to chaos, I said, based on feedback and comments and opinions and other posts on Discord and on Patreon, I said, a lot of people have a lot of opinions about this topic, so maybe we should ask everyone what their favorite licensed 8-bit game is. And I put out a call for letters, and a lot of you responded. We got more than 30 letters for this episode. So I think what we're going to do is I'm going to read the letters from my inbox, which the others do not have access to, thanks to my great personal security and not sharing my passwords on the internet with strangers. And then Stuart and Kurt are going to weigh in with their thoughts on the games in question. I feel like the two of you will probably have more to say about licensed 8-bit games than I will, because my experience with that segment of video games is actually pretty small. So compared to you, like, I feel like both of you sort of live and breathe that sort of thing. So in this case, I am really sort of just here to start topics of conversation and then let the experts weigh in on you, the listener, weighing in. It's very recursive. I apologize for that, but not really. So any thoughts before we get started? Any last words, any regrets you need to express about getting involved in this?
Did anyone say Bart versus the Space Mutants like I did?
I have not actually read any of these letters yet.
Oh.
I wanted them to come.
Oh, it's going to be a surprise.
I wanted them to be
everyone.
A surprise. They could all just be porn spam. And, you know, they just had the correct title in the subject line. So I just dropped them into my mailbox.
You got to read them all out loud, even if they are porn spam.
No, especially if they're porn spam.
Yeah.
This is the greatest 8-bit licensed game of all time. I'm Juicy Lucy. Won't you play slots with me? Thank you. So we are just going to have no more ado. We are just going to read. I am going to read, and you are going to respond. Okay. Yes. Good. Here we go. From Trick the TM, or Trick That M, something like that. Hi, Retronauts. Figured instead of shouting out an obvious great 8-bit licensed game like DuckTales, you just shouted it out. I'd highlight a favorite from childhood. Star Trek 25th Anniversary by Konami as Ultra and Interplay. It was probably my first experience with adventure games, though this was done in an overhead Zelda-style game. The format enabled it to be more playable than most other adventure game attempts in retrospect. It did also have admirable attempts at replicating the TOS music and had kind of hilarious attempts to recreate the likenesses of Kirk and Spock. Wish this would get a re-release, but I'm sure the rights are a mess. Gentlemen?
The only Star Trek game I've ever played is Star Trek The Next Generation, the advanced holodeck tutorial on the Game Gear, so I can't help with this, I'm afraid.
I did play it several years ago, and I enjoyed it, but not enough to offhand say much about it. I mean, my favorite Star Trek ones were those adventure games that they put out in the 90s.
Demon World!
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry, I lied. I have also played Star Trek Generations Beyond the Nexus, also on the Game Gear. But I don't really remember anything about it. Apparently, I gave it 4 stars out of 5, though.
Wow.
So it's got to be pretty good, yeah.
You're like, finally, we killed that jackass Captain Kirk.
Well, you know, I never did much. Like, I was never into Star Trek. I had no malice towards it. But then, like, last year, I watched a bunch of TNG, and I was like, you know what? Pretty good. Pretty enjoyable. Liked it.
It is, in fact, a pretty good show.
And that was only from, like, seasons 1 and 2 as well, so...
Wow, you didn't even see the things that were actually good.
No, I didn't. I just saw complete garbage. Loved it.
There is something charming about the garbage, except the really, really racist episode we don't talk about.
Oh, I did watch that one. It was really racist, yeah.
It was, yeah, just shocking for the 1980s,
it's
even.
Code of Honor or something, right?
Yeah. Oh, we're not talking about it. That's right. Oh, okay. So anyway, I guess we can safely say that we do not have a lot of opinions about Trick the TM's opinion. About Star Trek 25th Anniversary. I will eventually play it for NES Works, but I think it's still a couple of years away. So, and by that I mean a couple of years of game chronology away, which means like a decade or three away for me.
You'll get there.
So look forward to my episode when I'm 80. All right, here is one from Andy. I don't know if that's the same Andy from The King of Fighters and Fatal Fury, but maybe... Maybe Mai will weigh in.
It is.
Okay, great. I'd have to say the greatest 8-bit licensed game for me is Top Gun. The movie being one of my favorites that summer, along with the game tie-in, made me fall in love with the idea of joining the Navy when I grew up so that I could fly an F-14. I discovered music a few years later, and thankfully I never went through on that thought. It also made me a lifelong inverted Y-axis guy on all my camera controls, up until Resident Evil Revelations on 3DS. Its gyro aiming feature, which I love, is still broken. If you invert the X-axis for the right stick, it also inverts the gyro aiming, rendering it completely useless. I've now retrained my brain not to invert the Y-axis, unless I'm flying something. To top off my nomination for the best 8-bit licensed game, Top Gun, I had my mom take a picture of my high score that made it to the pages of Nintendo Power. It wasn't some random issue either. It was the one that has one of our favorite series on the cover. The second issue, the notorious Castlevania II Simon's Quest issue. I still have my original copy, which unfortunately has none of the Castlevania maps in it anymore. I cut them out as a kid and hung them on the wall. Anyway, this is not an email about Castlevania. It's about Top Gun. Kind of like that last one wasn't about... Star Trek The Next Generation, it was about DuckTales.
Most of that one was about Resident Evil.
So I've got that issue of Nintendo Power really close at hand, so I'm going to go get that while I let the two of you share your thoughts on Top Gun, presumably the 8-bit, the NES Top Gun. I know there were a couple of others, but I feel like that's the one that people have in mind.
I think this is going to turn out to be quite a risky episode for me to appear on, because I've neither seen Top Gun nor played Top Gun.
Oh, I had never played. I haven't seen Top Gun until a couple of years ago, and I didn't think it was very good.
No.
And then I saw Top Gun Maverick, and that was excellent. But the Nintendo game, I played Afterburner so much before I played the NES Top Gun.
Is that the one with the really famous angry video game nerd bit where he can't land it on the carrier and he keeps going in the room? Okay, yeah. So that's pretty funny. So I guess that's my comment on this. That's pretty funny, that bit of angry video game nerd.
There was a recent angry video game nerd game that came out where one of the bosses is the jet fighter.
Oh, the 8-bit one. Yeah, that was pretty good. That was good. I like that. Yeah.
Is that the one? I might be misremembering, but I think like the Nintendo version was silent, and I think the PlayChoice 10 version had music or something like that. Like, it strikes me really weird that did that have music in it?
Top Gun?
Like, it was
the Japanese right? version had music. The American version did not. The Japanese version came out a month later than the American version, and they added music for it. So we kind of got the short end of the stick. It does have the intro music.
Yes,
does
it have playing with the
opening screen? But the actual gameplay is silent on NES.
There should be like there should be like a mini game where you play like volleyball with the boys. That would be good.
That's called King of the Beach.
The Goonies,
awesome.
The Goonies 2 game had that awesome Cyndi Lauper rendition, and this could have had an 8-bit chiptune Mighty Wings.
Goonies 2 mentioned.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah. It's a complete Paris episode. Activated. Thanks, everyone. Good night. So I am looking here in issue 2 of Nintendo Power, and sure enough, in the Players Forum, NES Achievers, under Top Gun, third place for the month is one Andrew Webb from LaGrange, Illinois, with 71,000 points. Pretty damn good, but nowhere near Josh Vinzant from Nannyville, Missouri, who had 127,200 points in Top Gun.
Jeez,
I don't know how you
double.
Get to that score, but go outside, touch grass. I don't know.
I mean,
that's too many points.
The thing is, without knowing how the scoring works, I have no idea if any of that is impressive, because it might be easy to get 120,000 points. Like, you know, like you dodge.
And he's
one,
the only one
like,
who bothered to send in an email.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
photo.
Yeah.
Could be.
Mighty right. Wings, that was a good song too.
Mighty Wings.
All right. Yeah.
Yeah.
That was my favorite mockumentary, A Mighty Wing. JP Friction writes to us and says, "This one has already gotten a surprising and welcome amount of love from the Retronauts crew. Oh, it must be Tower of Jiraga. But I have to vote for, Friday the 13th for NES. Like everyone else in the world, I rented this as a child and got immediately destroyed by Jason, so assumed it was terrible and moved on with my life. My college roommate had a soft spot for it, however, and showed me the trick of getting the best weapon very quickly. Once you do that for a few counselors, the game turns into a race to hunt Jason down as quickly as possible, and you can start doing things like follow him out of the cabins and ambush him on the path, or camp out next to his favorite spot to enter the lake when he decides to go after the kids on the island. Great fun, and we always set aside an hour every Friday the 13th, which means that this is being recorded Friday the 13th of March 2026, and therefore JP Friction may be playing this game as we record JP Friction, reading JP Friction's letter about playing this game. That's so meta. Anyway, he says, we do that to take Jason out so it doesn't cause too much trouble. You're welcome, everyone. Love to see a couple of improvements, of course. Lots of unused space on the map, and the actual way you were supposed to get the hint to find the torch weapon is tedious at best. If only someone with a talent for releasing licensed NES games with cool new content could get a hold of this one." I feel like that's a pointed remark, but I'm going to let it just slide on past, friction-free, and let the two of you share your thoughts on Friday the 13th. Surely you have thoughts on Friday the 13th.
JP friction free. That's where that word came from. Yeah, yeah. I have thoughts about the movies, but once again, this is three for three, I'm afraid. I think that I might be completely dead weight on this podcast, you see. I mean, I can only assume, based on this incredible quality of every single one of the Friday the 13th movies, that this is a tremendous game that the series deserves, you know? It sounds like getting destroyed by Jason immediately is kind of the intended experience, though, like if you're trying to simulate that whole world, you know? People don't tend to last long around him. Especially not teenagers.
Hmm. Kurt, do you have a counterpoint, a riposte? Riposte?
I talked about this game on Retronauts a while ago, and this was one of those ones I never played at the time because it had, there's some magazine that gave it a really bad review and just had that reputation of.
Yeah, it had LJN in the box, that's always a bad sign.
Yeah, and as an adult, played it and of course got a meat
frightened,
thrashed it. But is a game that once you learn how to play it, it's quite ambitious, especially for a licensed game. It is one of those ones that just needed a lot more time to play test it. I'm sure they didn't play test it much at all because everybody has the same experience about getting killed at Jason and just throwing the cartridge out the window. They had no idea what they were doing. But it is due for a remake. It's a neat.
Is it as good as the Nightmare on Elm Street game?
That's a hard question to answer because the Nightmare of Elmster game is on a basic level is like more direct. Yeah, like you understand how to play it, but it's a lot more ambitious.
Yeah, that question is kind of like, do you prefer being punched in the crotch or kicked in the crotch?
It's a
similar experience, but a different, you know, vehicle for getting to that point. No, the thing about Friday the 13th is it is a really, like Kurt said, a really ambitious game. It has real-time gameplay. You have a party of counselors that you can swap between. In addition to managing your counselors' lives, you also have to protect children while venturing out into the world to find the tools you need to fight Jason. There are kind of different modes of play, like the side-scrolling world map, which kind of is like Rambo's for NES, where you can switch tracks north, south, you know, go in different directions and sort of track your progression around a map screen that you can pull up. And then you have like the first person mode, which is sort of like an adventure game, but then it's sometimes kind of like Punch Out. It's they were doing a lot, but as Kurt said, it needed more time in the oven because I'm sure LJN was like, here's $10 and some pocket lint. Make us the best game you can. And they spent, you know, 3 weeks on it and said, well, now we're all sleeping under our desks and we have to go to the hospital because we haven't eaten in 3 weeks. So we're shipping this as it is. That was kind of the game, Japanese game development environment back in the 80s and 90s and 2020s. I'm sure a rough experience for the people who made the game. But they really tried something with it. It just, you know, didn't have quite enough going for it, probably in terms of time and budget, to really pan out.
Like the movies.
Perhaps. Okay, so that was Friday the 13th. A good call for a game that could have been better and maybe someday will be better. I cannot say. Literally, I have no idea. I'm not working on it. Jason Williams says, for me, it's TMNT2, the arcade game. At the time, it felt like an arcade at home. Of course, now I realize it's not even close, but a fun time was still had by all. And no, I did not chop up my instruction manual for a free pizza. Even 14-year-old me had better sense than that. I, on the other hand, got my free personal pan pizza. Hell yeah.
I mean, I would have got the pizza. I mean, more sense than that. What's sensible about refusing a free pizza? Nothing. That's
spent $50 on the game. You're damn right I'm going to get a pizza out of it.
Yeah, that's very wise. I have played this game. I can actually talk about this game, you see. I mean, it's all right, isn't it? I mean, it's fine. It's good if you got like a friend, but then it's, as mentioned, it's one of those things I think where you sort of look back and you have so many options that are superior that it kind of pales in comparison. I mean, I kind of I like the first Turtles game, you know, the one that everyone hates wrongly. I like that one a lot more. I think that's more fun to play kind of as a single player thing. But yeah, this is good. And then, you know, the Manhattan Project's even better. So there we go.
This game was good. I don't think the fighting transferred over properly. The way that you hit guys just doesn't quite feel right. That always took me out of it even when I was a kid. But I remember walking out of Toys R Us with this game and spending $50. Like, well, I'd probably spend like $50 worth of quarters in this thing anyway, so might as well take it.
Did you get the pizza?
Yes, damn I right. did. We went there. We were that was during the time of Book It, the Pizza Hut pizza program. So we were out there pretty regularly.
Yeah, I think our Pizza Hut had a program where if you had straight A's on your report card each marking period, you could trade that in for a free pizza. So. And then they would stamp it to say, like, you got your pizza. So, yeah, I was eating a lot of free pizza back around 1990.
And
thank you,
wasn't.
Pizza Hut.
I do. I would sit and watch the flickering flame effect in the first level. It's one of those, like, subtle things that just done really, really well.
Yeah, there were some neat graphical effects, like the rolling steel balls that come down the stairways in the first level. Mm-hmm. Some of the effects were pretty impressive for NES, and also the NES version, it added several levels that were not in the arcade game, so it didn't feel like, you know, it couldn't be a direct port of the arcade game because you couldn't have four players. Technically, you know, the four player adapter existed by that point, but good luck getting that to work on the NES when the two player version was a flicker, just like sheer hell. Mm-hmm. But yeah, like you couldn't have the exact game, but you could have something that was approximately the game and also a little extra to sweeten the deal.
That's kind of like how they did Turtles in Time, the SNES version, for me, far superior even to the arcade one, because it was so much, I mean, it was closer to the graphics, but also it just felt so much more tight and polished, and it was great.
Oh, yeah, they really fixed the controls of that game. It's a lot less random than the arcade version is.
All right, TMNT2, we like it. Good job. Good job, Jason Williams. Next up, we have Leonard saying, my vote is for Capcom's Darkwing Duck. Ooh. Capcom was very good at making licensed games in this era. DuckTales and Rescue Rangers, and even their Little Mermaid game, took the branding of those licenses and injected them very well into existing formula. But I've always thought that Darkwing Duck was the best of those efforts. It's obviously a Mega Man clone, but retains the personality and tone of the cartoon quite strongly. It's fairly challenging in parts too, and has very catchy music.
Yeah, I like this game.
I feel like this game is gip-coded.
No, yeah, it's a good game. It's on the Disney Afternoon Collection. They just got re-released as well. Yeah, I like it. I got to complain about it, though, because you've given me a format to do that, which is like, I do dig it, but it sometimes feels like a Mega Man game where every enemy is a metal. Like, everything seems to hide from you and then pop up and then go back behind a shield or something, and that gets old, like, quite quickly. I always thought it was, like, a little bit more finicky than a Mega Man game. There's, like, a hanging on to things from underneath mechanic, like Strider. But I always found like it didn't, it, like 1 out of 100 times it doesn't work. And that's a very annoying ratio. but it's a good game. I just don't think it's up to Mega Man level. But I guess that's kind of an unfair thing to thrust on it, you know. And ducks are kind of stupid, you know. It's, just quacking and walking around. Not really.
Yeah, they'll eat any old bread. It doesn't matter how stale it is. Come on, guys. Yeah, have some dignity. Yeah. Have some class.
Well, can I do one of my favorite Mitch Hedberg bits? I find that a duck's opinion of me is very influenced by whether or not I have bread. That was
true.
He's very funny, even though I can't do the delivery.
Yeah, this game is really good. I mean, it hasn't been much that's been has been said already. The controls do feel a little stiff. I like the way it's balanced a little differently from a Mega Man game, because you can only take like 4 hits.
Yeah.
So it's just a little different. I don't find the gas powers to be particularly useful. But the bosses are well designed. The music, again, because it's a Capcom game, is excellent. It's solid.
It's real good. It's fun. It's like, you know, 4 out of 5. Mega Man's like 5 out of 5, but I like it a lot.
Yeah.
You know what isn't good? The TurboGrafx one. just throw that up there just in case anyone hadn't played that. I think nobody's played that, actually.
I'm sure that one's crazy expensive, too.
Not worth it. Don't pay for it.
All right. So, continuing our trend of not talking about Master System games this episode, we have Peter Thompson, who says, my favorite 8-bit licensed game was James Bond 007 for Game Boy. You'd think this game would be a run-and-gun platformer like so many other licensed games of the era, but it was a top-down action-adventure where you explore towns and talk to people before heading out into the world to explore and fight enemies, not too dissimilar to Zelda. Unfortunately, I was never able to beat the game because one of the zones has you exploring a casino where you need to win money to advance. Oh, like the Last Jedi. Being only 12 years old at the time and not understanding the rules to Baccarat led me to losing all my money time and time again. It did teach me an important life lesson, though. Don't gamble.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I won't feel bad. I am much older than 12 years old, and I have no idea how to play Baccarat.
They, you know, they dumbed it down to Texas Hold'em for Casino Royale because they were like, everyone's too stupid to understand Baccarat, so let's just do Texas Hold'em.
This was a pretty popular game in the UK, probably because of like pride, patriotism, maybe. Like, it seemed to be sort of naturally occurring. I remember at school at one point in the drama room in a cupboard that hadn't been used for anything else. There was just randomly a copy of it in there, just like the
cartridge. It's what you guys get instead of mildew, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so, you know, that you know, pick that up. The game is kind of interesting. It doesn't look good, even, like, for Game Boy, I would say. For its time, it's quite simple visually, but that doesn't really hurt it. I'm always going on about this, but I like Game Boy games that either don't scroll or don't have big, blurry sprites, you know? So, yeah, this was a pretty popular one. I can't say I ever really got anywhere on it, though, because it was kind of difficult, but, yeah. I was hoping you were going to say James Bond the Duel, but then I remembered that you weren't doing Sega games. it's like a Sega-less episode.
Yeah, I wonder how the planning for this Wii game went, because it is clearly Zelda. Mm-hmm. Somebody must have been like, okay, Link's Awakening.
Oh, I mean,
great.
it's got the font in there. It's
yeah, it's like,
wasn't this
clear.
A Rare game? Rare developed?
I don't think so.
No, I don't remember who did it, but I don't think it was like it was. I mean, Nintendo had the whole GoldenEye thing. I think it probably predated that.
I'm looking it up now.
I can't remember.
No, it was 1998. It was a late Game Boy game. That's why. Yeah.
Oh, it's a late one.
It was Sapphire, developed by Sapphire, who also developed quite a lot of games.
The cool folks who gave us Nestor's Funky Bowling.
Oh, geez, yeah, you're right. But more importantly, they gave us Oddworld Adventures and Oddworld Adventures 2.
Did they?
Well, yeah, like, apparently.
Oh, for Game Boy, the ports. Okay, yes.
Yeah.
Since all the other James Bond games outside of GoldenEye, they were like side-scrolling or just like arcade-y action games, the fact that something would take like an adventure-style game, like it works well for Bond. It's really clever.
Yeah, I can say for certainty that Sapphire's first game was Nestor's Funky Bowling, and this was their third. So... There's a real progression, a real lineage there, a heritage that everyone should be proud of. All right, so moving along, we have Graham Forrest, who says, so I gave some thought to the topic at hand, and all the licensed games seem to follow the same formula. Bright, colorful, loading title screen with decent pixel art, absolute banger of a theme tune. If they're really pushing the boat out, some digitized speech that you would be forgiven for mistaking as a toilet flush. Inevitably disappointing and at best tangentially related to the property gameplay. Bonus points that the license is something wildly unsuitable for kids. As the best example of this, I nominate Activision's version of The Predator. Thanks and good night, everyone.
What a cynical email.
I know. Can you imagine having cynical opinions about video games? What a terrible life that must be.
It was ghastly. It hurt my ears just to hear it. I mean, that seems like the digitized speech thing. That seems very specific. They're talking about Ghostbusters. Like, there's got to be
Ghostbusters. Could be. I don't know. Are there a lot of digitized or games with digitized speech on the title screen?
On the title screen, I can only think of that and the excellent Dizzy Collection, where it says "Let's play Dizzy," but that's not a video game. Well, it is a video game, barely, but it's not a licensed game.
And until they went with that part, I was thinking he was going for Silver Surfer, which has some incredible music.
Oh yeah, that's also getting really
sure
good
is
soon as well.
Yes, indeed.
Good lord.
Yeah.
Can't wait. No, I haven't played this Predator game. Please tell me all
Predator,
about it.
Predator, it's by Pakken Video, and they were a company that did a lot of they made a lot of licensed games on NES and Famicom, and they really put their backs into it. They did the work. They tried to interpret games in interesting ways. Like, they made Die Hard, which is a real-time strategy shooter game that takes place in Nakatomi Plaza, the building. And all the terrorists have like real-time routes that they're sort of prescribed to. And so you have to like learn the processes and set traps and stuff. It's really cool. It's also not fun to play, but God, they really went for it. This is one where I don't think they really had anything kind of in the tank for this one. It's a really bad platformer.
I looked it up and it's
like, what if Contra weren't good? But the thing that's like the big selling point, quote unquote, for this game is Big Mode, where you control a really huge Arnold Schwarzenegger who runs and it kind of auto scrolls. So it's, you know, kind of trying to be like the Kung Fu China Warrior or something like that. But boy, I don't know. Yeah, not good.
Oh well, that looks wow.
Like, yes, you did that with the technology. Good on you, but no, don't do that with the technology.
The Contra bits.
No, they're bad.
Too bad.
Oh, visually.
Okay.
No, it doesn't. It's very strange.
I think there was a vaguely interesting thing raised there, which is it wasn't vaguely interesting. That's a bit rude. It was interesting, which was the whole thing about like the game not relating to the property, and like how important is that really for a good game? Like, I don't get it. It's. I think most of the classic licensed games I can think of, you'll be playing as the character from it, but then the rest of it is just a bunch of stuff that didn't happen in the movie. That doesn't really matter to me.
It kind of depends. Like, going on the Die Hard tangent, the PC Engine version of that game, it was very clearly like some other commando game that the developer had lying around. They stapled onto it because the first level takes place in the Los Angeles jungle.
I got lost there at E3.
I'm quite a big fan of the Blues Brothers games, and those are about throwing crates at lawnmowers that are sentient. That doesn't happen in the movie. And I've seen the extended
version. I feel like Carrie Fisher, at some point, her character sends a sentient lawnmower after Jake.
Actually, there's a point I could see her doing that, yeah.
The bazooka didn't work, but here's a lawnmower. It's the Lawnmower Man. 10 years ahead of its time.
My long-standing theory is that the Blues Brothers games were originally Titus the Fox games on console, but they then got the Blues Brothers license and went put the Blues Brothers in.
That's a pretty good theory.
I will stand by that.
Wasn't it originally like a French comedian?
Oh yeah, the Titus the Fox was. It was. Yeah. I can't remember. It was some racist thing, wasn't it? I can't remember the guy's name, but yeah, you're right. But I still stand by it because there's tons of stuff in the Blues Brothers games that is from Titus the Fox. I don't know if it was just that they were being. I don't like saying lazy, but they were being a spendthrift. They were being sensible, or they got the license and went, quick, put them in there. Because, you can collect a cake and become really ripped, and that's not what happens when you eat a cake. Otherwise, look at me.
I can't. You've got your camera off.
Well, you already
know. I know nothing. All I know is that when I'm around you, like, the top of your head is actually obscured by clouds. I can't see the top of it.
Oh, that's good, because if you could, you would be blinded immediately by the reflection of the light.
I feel like the windfish is up there just waiting.
Yeah, I could make a pretty obvious joke about that, but I won't.
Okay. I mean, this is your Viz moment. You got a Beano, maybe.
Yeah. No, I'm going to let it go. No. I talked about Vision last recording.
I mean, it's, you know, just I'm going to talk about Sokoban or Zevius at some point. So we've all got our bits. Kurt, that's did you true. Have any thoughts on that? Did you share your thoughts? I can't remember. We were talking about farts, basically.
Again, you covered it. It's like Contra, but it's bad. I think I came to the conclusion that those big moves were probably inspired by that one Namco arcade mm-hmm. game.
Genpei Tomaden.
And the Heikki yeah. clans. Yeah, Genpei Tomaden, which is one of those games that had like no presence over here, but was like a cult classic over there. I don't think I've seen very many games that were inspired by that. I mean,
that's on one of the Namco museums, right? Genpei Tomaden. Mm-hmm. Am I? Yeah.
Yeah, that was.
It's a very, very trippy, very surreal game. Yes. But it has the same, like, when you go through the stages, there's tiny little demon dude, and then there's big mode stages where you turn to a big demon dude.
I just like
dude.
The phrase big mode. That makes me really happy.
Yeah.
You do not play chopsticks on a piano. Sorry to disappoint. Curtis Bostick says, I think one of my favorite 8-bit licensed games is WWF Betrayal for the Game Boy Color. Is it a good beat-em-up? No. It definitely doesn't stand up to the final fights of the world. There's not really much depth to the combat. Some of the boss fights just spam attacks at you with no room for reaction time, and overall, it's kind of a mess. But for whatever reason, I just can't stop revisiting it every few years. That was my William Shatner impression. I can't stress enough that the game isn't good, but I still, for whatever reason, unironically enjoy playing it. I did not realize that this was a beat 'em up. I just assume, you know, you see WWF, it's going to be you're in the ring and you're punching guys, grabbing them.
It's height of the Attitude Era. It's way forward made. This is one of the first games, I think. And it's you can play as I think The Rock or Steve Austin and maybe one other, maybe Mankind. And it's not bad for what it is. It's fine. I would say this obviously, but I think they're slightly underselling it there. I think it's pretty good. It reviewed pretty well at the time. And you got to, like, you know, but the Game Boy Color is not a system that can really do that genre. So I think they did a pretty decent job overall. I love WayForward, though. I'm going to cut them some slack. They do a good job.
Yeah, they're like Pac-In Video in that they always, you know, with those 8-bit games, they always went above and beyond what they needed to and tried to do something interesting. And unlike Pac-In Video, they had some technical chops. So you're not like, you know, playing Predator.
I think we all know that the real WWF Betrayal was the Montreal Screwjob.
I don't know that one. Is that like the Venus Butterfly?
No, it's when they stole the title off of Bret the Hitman Hart by ringing the bell when he hadn't submitted. It's one of the biggest scandals in all of wrestling.
Wow.
Bret the Hitman Hart punched Vince McMahon so hard that he went flying across the locker room, apparently.
That's pretty cool. I feel like if there's a guy who needs to be punched across a locker room, it's probably Vince McMahon.
I think he needs to be punched across a cemetery into an open grave.
I think that's the Undertaker's job. That's the extent of my knowledge of wrestling. True. Thank you, everyone. Good night.
Yeah. Well, you know, wrestling, it's the best thing.
Kurt, do you have anything to add to this scintillating conversation?
No, this is a game that I read about years ago. It's like, oh, it's a beat 'em up. That sounds really neat. And then promptly forgot about it and never played it. Maybe I'll try again.
I like to almost play a game and not actually do it. I do that all the time. I have so many games I've almost played but haven't.
I really like that. Did you play that? Almost, yeah.
I came close. I looked at the cartridge. I was like, I could put this in my Switch.
Yeah, but I'm not gonna.
Yeah, story of my life. I think most people call that a backlog, but me, I call it good intents. So David Mathias says, the greatest licensed game of the 8-bit era is easily Gunhead, a.k.a. Blazing Lasers, with a lot of Z's in there. The movie was about a group of scavengers looking for miracle energy source Tex-Mexium. Cinco de Mayo is coming up soon. I'm going to be on the hunt for that, too. On an island with an evil computer and heroic mech. Compile's shooter had none of that, except an evil computer as the final boss. Even the titular Gunhead mech doesn't appear in the game Gunhead. The game is one of the greatest shooters of all time, and maybe it got there by just ignoring its source material, which kind of gets back to what we were saying earlier. Someone was saying.
Yeah. I thought Blazing Lasers was like a pack-in with the TurboGrafx or something.
Gate of Thunder. It was one of the Thunder games. Yeah.
Gate of Thunder, yeah.
I never knew that was a licensed game at all, Blazing Lasers. That's interesting.
It's barely a licensed game in Japan.
Oh, yeah, true. It was
clearly like something that just got stapled on.
Yeah, it worked out in this case, I guess.
It worked really well because Blazing Lasers is excellent.
It was originally a Titus Fox game, actually.
I've mentioned this before, but there's that like computing museum in Cambridge where they have all the retro hardware, and this is the game they have set up on TurboGrafx, Blazing Lasers, and it's really good fun. I really like it.
I mean, this was because Hudson was doing all those carnival competitions, and they were based off of stuff that they had made originally, like Star Soldier and Starship Hector. And for this, for whatever reason, they outsourced it to Compile. And Compile, they know what they're doing. Like, they're sort of similar, but they definitely feel like calling this an 8-bit game is a little bit of a push because it is on the TurboGrafx-16, but...
There were some questions in our Discord about, is TurboGrafx-16 acceptable? In my heart, I say no, but I guess if you want to be technical about it, yes, because it had an 8-bit processor.
I feel like 8-bit is an aesthetic, though. It's not like... I mean, I look at a game, like something like... I know TurboGrafx, like... almost any TurboGrafx game I can think of, and I just think, no, that looks like a Mega Drive game. I can't call that 8-bit. I just can't.
Yeah, I mean, you know, TurboGrafx was literally an NES with, like, a crazy awesome graphics processor. We touched on this, talked about it quite a bit in the TurboGrafx episode we recorded last fall. Kurt, you were there, right? At Portland Retro Expo?
No, I wasn't at Portland.
Or not Portland, sorry. Retro World Expo.
The Hudson.
It was an imposter.
Yeah.
The Connecticut where we were talking about Hudson.
Yeah, Hudson, they knew the NES, the Famicom hardware really well, but they wanted more juice for it. So they said, fine, let's just make our own, with Blackjack and Hookers. But they skipped the Blackjack and Hookers and instead just put a really great graphics chip in there that gave the PC Engine, TurboGrafx, much, much better capabilities, more power than the NES had, even though they are kind of running basically on the same chip fundamentally. So, it's one of those weird things. Like, the Master System, it's a much more impressive system in a lot of respects than the NES, but the CPU powering it is the same as the ColecoVision and SG-1000. So it's really all about the graphics processor. Those little guys, they can do so much. And that's why they're really expensive now, because the AI companies bought them all up to do crypto mining or whatever. It's very sad.
Oh, yeah. Blazing Lasers, it set down the template for basically every vertical PC Engine shooter that came after it. Like, there's so many other games that are, like, from Compile, from other developers that are just like Blazing Lasers. But it's still, despite being, like, a Compile game that sort of established that stuff, it's still an excellent game.
You mentioned I'm sorry, but I have to ask this. You mentioned the carnival thing, right? Now, the only time I've heard that referenced and for my sins is that game Summer Carnival 92 Wrecker. That's a thing, like Carnival.
Oh, Caravan.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Sorry. Carnival.
I got confused because I thought Carnival was a thing.
Carnival is a thing, but that was by its competitor.
Right, Maxa. Right. Okay, sorry. That was not meant to be a call-out. I genuinely didn't know. I also don't really know what a caravan is, but I understand you only have like 5 minutes in it or something like that. It's like a score attack thing, right? I don't know.
Yeah, there was score attack, and most of the games were shoot-em-ups.
Are they called Caravan?
There's one of them that was a sports game. I think there's a Bomberman game near the end. But yeah, they were big.
Right, cool. Interesting. I have to look into this because that's very interesting. I don't know anything about this whole caravan business.
Isn't that that 12-player Bomberman that ran on like an early HD screen. Wasn't that created for the Caravan Carnival? Oh. Caravan?
What is that called again? High-ten Bomberman.
High-ten Bomberman. Yeah, that's it.
Yeah, high-ten Bomberman.
I guess
yeah.
it was 10 people? Okay.
Well, higher than 10. So.
Oh, okay. High yeah, 10. There we go. Mm-hmm. It's like two high fives.
Yeah, it's one of those things I've heard a million times. Caravan. And I've never, ever thought to go, what the hell does that mean? And look into it for some reason. Idiot.
I've posted a couple of VHS tapes that have on my YouTube channel that have.
Yeah, but I don't have a player anymore.
Well, the good news is that you have YouTube, so you can watch it there on my YouTube channel because I've posted it there. You don't even have to rewind when you're done.
Okay.
There's no kindness on today's internet.
I'm sorry, I was being silly.
So Ben Roberts says, I was delighted to hear you quite correctly mention Willow as the best licensed 8-bit game. As a personal favorite, Gremlins 2, the new batch by Sunsoft, is also tops. The music, the breezy length, the progressive challenge, and the delightful personality-filled graphics make it a perennial favorite of mine since its release. Bonus, it seems as though the scenario developer may have actually watched the movie as well, a relative rarity for licensed games at the time.
This is the NES game, presumably.
Yes, because one has a good reputation, and the Game Boy one I have played, and it seems like an exercise in just like creating the Torment Nexus by someone who really hated children.
I think this is one of those situations where because I played the Game Boy one when I was a little kid, it's stuck in my head as a good game. But the NES game is lots of fun. It has super good music. But then again, so does the Game Boy game. The music kind of makes up for it.
Yeah, I don't think the Game Boy game is bad. I think it just hates everyone. And, you know, if you can stomach that, you can
I can't get past that level two, obviously.
Okay, yeah.
No one can. But no, the NES game is really cool, really interesting, and sort of different as well, I find. It's not the platformer that you'd probably expect it to be. It's that kind of top-down, really smooth-moving, well-designed kind of business. I saw the movie like this year for the first time. It's really, really loud. It gave me a headache.
Did you consider turning down the volume?
I suppose I could have done that. But mostly it's just that I think the Gremlins are just a pain in the ass, to be honest. I mean, that's kind of the point of the movie. But
right.
I thought they could have given it a bit of a rest sometimes, you know.
This game, it threw me for a loop a little bit because it's a top-down game, but it has platforming. There's a lot of shifting little bits so you could fall in a pit. It took me a while to get used to it. I love that you get new weapons every level. I love that there's a money system where you talk to the old Chinese guy who I'm pretty sure was revealed to have died in the movie, so it's nice to see him again. No, it's good. Solid music.
Okay. At some point, I will play that on NES for NES Works, but not today. We have our first repeat offender here. William Quizada says, hello, Retronauts. I'm going to give a shout out to Darkwing Duck on the NES, a difficult game with amazing graphics. So that's two votes. That means maybe Darkwing Duck is the best licensed 8-bit game.
It's looking that way, yes.
Not a bad choice.
All right. Renaissance 2K says, hi, I'm sure I'm one of hundreds making this pick, but I think DuckTales for the NES Famicom is the best 8-bit licensed game. One, it's faithful to the source material, featuring colorful cartoon-accurate sprites and a non-linear level select that matches the series' adventuring spirit. As an accessible platformer with a kid-friendly but still cool pogo weapon, it's equally faithful to the source material's fans, when it could have just as easily been a lifeless adventure game or whatever the heck Back to the Future was. Moon Theme is a masterpiece, so much so it played an Uno reverse card and influenced the plot and music of the DuckTales cartoon reboot that aired in 2017. Thank you for attending my TED Talk and for all your awesome work.
I mean... No, sorry, go on, Kai. I didn't mean to talk over you.
Oh, sorry. I have a fond memory of this game. When I bought my Nintendo in 1990 after saving up Christmas money, my dad let me pick out a game to get, and it was between DuckTales and Mega Man 2. And I got DuckTales, and I felt really mixed about it because I beat it very quickly. It's not a long or an easy, it's not a long or a difficult game. But I remember talking to some other kid at school, and I asked him, you know, did I make the right choice here? And he was like, there was no wrong choice. These are both excellent games. And that, because I was a child, I was easily influenced by my peers. It sort of caused me to reassess the game. Like, oh, this was actually really neat. And I liked the fact that there were multiple endings based off of how much treasure you got. Because there's a lot of hidden stuff in this game. So it was neat to go around and find all the different jewels and stuff. And I think, I don't know if it was an ending that you could actually get or if it was something that was dummied out where you can lose all your money.
I feel like you can, but it's really difficult. Like you have to get a really specific scenario.
Yeah. I read an explanation. You have to like do very specific things in order to hit exactly zero at the end. So it is technically achievable, but you really have to game the game.
I mean, yeah. I mean, it's a great game. It's obviously a great game. I think this. I mean, you know, Hand on Heart might prefer the second one. Even that's like either that or it's just as good. It's a really really enjoyable sequel, and also it got rid of the holding down to do the pogo thing, which was the only thing wrong with the original game. But yeah, no, it's amazing. I still go back and play it every so often because it's just impossible not to do a run through when you pick it up. I even liked the that remake they did, remastered or whatever it was called. It just holds up really well, and as mentioned, the moon theme is kind of immortal. Yeah, DuckTales.
The fact that it is so short and easy makes it's very breezy to pick up.
Yeah. It's exactly. That's something that a lot of the best licensed NES games have in common, and 16-bit games is that you can just be like, you know what, I don't feel like playing some like epic today. I'm just going to blap through Buster's Hidden Treasure again and have the best day ever.
Yeah, I played this game earnestly for the first time this year. To make a video about it, or I guess last year.
You couldn't hear my jaw dropping.
I just didn't really do licensed games as a kid. And, you know, DuckTales, I was kind of too old for the cartoon at the time that the game came out, so I was kind of like, I don't care. It's actually really good. Like, there's one part that gets me every time. I cannot pogo past the rolling boulder in the narrow passage, so that kind of wrecks me. But that's just, you know, that's a me problem. I just can't figure out the timing on it. But it's really good. And, you know, I think the fact that it's relatively pretty easy and very short are marks in its favor because it was very much meant to be a beginner-friendly game. You know, it was made by a lot of the same people who made the Mega Man games, but it's much more approachable. It was really kind of created with, you know, the awareness that it was for a specific audience. And it really, I think, really hits the mark. And it is one of the great NES games. And I, you know, again, I say this as someone with zero nostalgia for it. It's just really damn good.
This is a complete, well, it's not a non sequitur, but I just want to mention how much I love the fact that when you pogo onto the snow in the Himalayas, you just go straight into it. I think that's such a cute touch. Yeah. Like, strategically, it's interesting as well. It prevents you from just bouncing everywhere. It's clever. Clever, man.
Darth Obvious says, Star Wars on NES was my introduction to the whole franchise. If you look at that game without having any knowledge of the movie first, it's really easy to look at it as a pretty average action game. It is funny, though, that a speedrun of the game means that you just straight up steal the Falcon, go to the Death Star, which you can then leave without Leia or R2, but still find the Rebel base and blow up the Death Star, presumably with Leia still on it. So there you go.
I never thought about that alternate reality, huh?
This is, I played this one a bit. I think they ported it to the Master System kind of late, but I have played the NES version. I thought this was, like, really hard, especially once you get to the Death Star, and it's just really long platforming stages with loads and loads of low-gravity stuff that just seemed to go on and on. I mean, it was fun, though. I did like it. I'm going to be a massive nerd now. I know the answer to this question, but I'm going to ask it for the purpose of discussion. There are two games called Star Wars for the NES, right? There's, like, the one where Darth Vader turns into a scorpion and the one where he doesn't.
That was only on Famicom. That wasn't.
Oh, was it? I apologize. Yeah.
Yeah, that was by Namco, and this one was. I think JVC. Somebody at Lucasfilms JVC. Like looking at me like, we cannot put out this game. It is too weird.
I think it might have been Sculptured Software. That made the one that was actually released here.
Yeah.
Didn't they do Super Star Wars as well?
They did a lot of stuff.
Oh, okay.
Sculpture Software was...
Super Star Wars is impossible.
It is, yes.
This game, it began with you're on your speeder and you can go, zoom around Tatooine. You had to do some quests. It's one of those things that, probably was nice on paper, but it kind of just, sucked all the momentum out of the game. Sorry, my bad.
It was Beam Software, the Back to the Future guys.
Oh, wow. That makes it even more impressive that this isn't a big piece of shit.
Oh, yeah. This is a big step up, yeah.
All right. Star Wars. So Christopher Boyer says, I'm in a minority here, but I have always had a soft spot for the Karate Kid game from LJN. I know it takes its lumps as being dicey to control, but I think if you learn it well, as a lot of us did when that was the only game you were going to get to play for a while, it is an okay side-scrolling fighter in the vein of Kung Fu, but with a rough approximation of Ralph Macchio, with fun minigames that pulled well from the movies. It's not the best on the platform, sure, but as licensed games go, it's a pretty good time.
So strangely paced, because the first level is supposed to be all of the first game, where it's just the karate tournament. Then you need to do that, and then it feels like you start the actual game based off Karate Kid 2 after that.
Oh, so you go to Okinawa. I think I did play this. I remember thinking that was really weird.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's just 1 and 2. It doesn't cover the third one as well.
No.
Okay. I think it looks pretty good. I think it was okay. It's got awkward kind of controls, but I thought it was pretty fun. And I got a lot of affection for the movies, so that carries it for me a little bit.
Does this one have the digitized yells? Because any karate game that has digitized yells whenever you punch is always at least an alright experience. I can't remember.
It did not.
Oh, okay. There's some sort of bonus levels I teach this to where you had to do something and then you would get special attacks, didn't it? I think you had the crane kick move, but you only had a limited number.
You got to catch the flies with the chopsticks. That's one of the bonus stages. I remember that.
Somebody made
I just think a
Commodore 64. Just entirely about that, yeah.
I think for its flaws, I think you can tell that they were trying here. I mean, was this Beam Software as well?
This was Atlas. This was actually the same.
Really?
Yeah, that made I don't know if it's the same people, but the same did who did Friday the 13th, which was way over designed for what they were going to do. But this is probably a little bit more in scope for what you'd expect from a Karate Kid game.
I'm going to give them props for trying so hard to fit so much from the movies into it, so recognizably. The level in the storm where you rescue the girl who's trapped up the tower, it's just like in Karate Kid 2. There's the low scenarios that you just recognize for the movies and go, oh yeah, I'm playing this bit. But I think that there's something to be said for that. So yeah, I've decided this is the greatest licensed game ever, just because I like the movie so much.
All right, I got really excited by this next letter. It's from Joe Hodgson. I misread it as Joel at first. I was like, whoa. But no, Joel Hodgson is not a Retronauts patron, as far as I'm aware. All right, he sent in three items. I'm going to read one of them. The Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles dominated the early 90s from a pop culture perspective and got numerous cracks at video games. The first is recalled not for being a good game, but for being a brutally challenging one for a target audience, mostly in kindergarten. The sequel is much celebrated, but for my money, the best TMNT game on the NES and the one most deserving of your time in 2026 is the third release, The Manhattan Project. No mention of tournament fighters. Such erasure. It does enough to the brawler gameplay returning from TMNT2 to make it more interesting than its predecessor via unique maneuvers for each character that also require a sacrificial amount of health in order to pull off, something a lot of games in the genre were starting to make use of. Fun locations and new enemies helped to round things out. If it weren't for Turtles in Time already lighting up arcades, it might have received more attention in the moment.
Yeah, it's awesome. We talked about it briefly earlier, but I didn't play this till really around when the Cowabunga collection came out. I may have like had a few minutes on it, but I never really sat down and gave it a proper go. And it keeps being impressive. Like, yeah, for NES, yes, but compared to the previous game, which is obviously still quite impressive as a port, this one's just constantly throwing like ideas and new scenarios at you. And I found it a lot more playable in general. It still has slowdown, it still has flickering, but it's just satisfying to play in a way that the previous one isn't. And, you know, Turtles in Time, Super Nintendo, that's always going to be the main Turtles game for me. But this is the best 8-bit one for me as well. Yeah, for sure.
They tuned up the fighting mechanics. You know, I mentioned how the original arcade game port felt a little off. This one feels a lot better just in how enemies bounce when you hit them. I don't think they have that invincibility period. You have that move where you can, like, jab them with your weapon and chuck them over your head. And the special moves... they actually take health before. Like, beating the original game was, if you could pull off that jumping swipe attack, you could beat almost anything. But this one's just a little more balanced, a little smarter designed. The music is excellent. It's a Konami game. It has lots of cool digitized samples, lots more cutscenes. Yeah, it was great.
It's graphically, I think, really impressive, despite sort of slowdown. Like, the surfing stage with the parallax water going past is really, really
it's
cool
nice,
looking.
Yeah.
And then you get like 8 foot soldiers at the same time jumping out after you, and it's like kind of, wow. I really dig it.
All right. Here's a letter from John, which includes something that I hadn't considered. My submission is Tecmo Super Bowl for NES. It was the first game to be licensed by both the NFL and the NFL Players Association, so it used real team and player names. The gameplay was incredibly solid, building on the simple play selection mechanics of its predecessor, and who can forget mowing down team after team with the famous Bo Jackson run play. The real kicker for me was its computer versus computer mode and its ability to simulate an entire NFL season, including playoffs. I spent hours experimenting with this mode, turning it into a unique and early glimpse at the sports management genre. While rooting for my hometown Denver Broncos, who rarely, if ever, emerged victorious. On a more personal level, Tecmo Super Bowl also represented a small intersection of gaming and sports that I, my dad, and my brother could all agree upon. So it holds a special place in my heart.
I only know about the Bo Jackson thing as a Family Guy.
I don't really like football games, but this is the best football game ever made. It will never be beaten. I played this game a ton as a kid, and I didn't really like most other sports games. It just feels crunchy. It feels nice. It's basically made by the Ninja Gaiden guys. So it has that like really arcade-style action. You have these great cutscenes that are just effortlessly spliced into the action. The music, just fantastic. I don't know why no other – I mean, I guess other football games, like people play football games don't care about video game music. But this was, again, Ninja Gaiden stuff. I loved it. But even back then, like I did sort of follow football, but there were a couple of players that I guess they were too important to have their identity licensed to the NFL or whatever. So you're just stuck with QB Bills. I don't know who the quarterback was back then, but I bet he's kicking himself now.
Kurt, are you looking forward to the Tecmo Bowl movie from the studio behind Pharrell Williams Piece by Piece?
Is that a thing?
Yes, I'm afraid so.
Oh, wow. Well, if they get the Ninja Gaiden guy to score it, then I'll be in.
Tecmo Super Bowl, I have no real opinion on sports games aside from the ones that I really enjoy are the ones that have an exhibition mode, so I don't have to play them to record footage for my videos. But this is one that is so dearly regarded, so revered, that it continues to receive fan-built ROM hacks every year that update the roster to the current NFL. And a few years ago, maybe I shouldn't admit this, I actually, for our staff Christmas party, gave a big sports fan on our team a physical version, like a ROM hack dump flash cartridge, whatever, of the current roster for the year. It's just an eternal game that people will continue updating until Tecmo destroys them.
Yeah, it's so acclaimed that even I, who know next to nothing about the rules of American football, though Diamond Fight did try and teach me them, and I sort of get it a bit more now, is interested in it. But unfortunately, unless it's sensible soccer or NES Open Tournament Golf, I just don't have any interest in playing it. Maybe one day I'll give it a go and see if I dig it. But those are the only two sports games as far as I'm concerned.
I generally like all golf games and all bowling games. Those are my sports genres. Use meters to make a ball go.
Yeah, golf in video games is so abstracted that I can enjoy it as its own thing rather than, hey, I'm playing a sport right now, you know? I don't know. I'm a big fan.
Ned Mulka says, Retronauts, you can say nostalgia blinds me, call it a guilty pleasure, but maybe I can describe it with some shit floats. I love Adventures in the Magic Kingdom. I adored it, playing it at a neighbor's house in the 90s. It's a small game, and the mini games were hit or mostly miss, but it fit perfectly in a rotation of cartridges as we just tried to entertain ourselves on those endless summer afternoons. I think the Big Thunder Railroad game is just chance, Autopia is too easy, Pirates of the Caribbean, and Haunted Mansion are both subpar Capcom platform levels, and Space Mountain is a simple but challenging QTE game, but with great music that matches the escalating excitement and a first-person view that actually feels like the roller coaster. Given how bad amusement park games tend to be, this can actually be seen as an early high watermark for the microgenre. This game deserved an iterative sequel. They could have come up with some better minigames or levels and a better overall structure. And lastly, there's a typo in the trivia minigame, and one of the answer choices is Steamboat Willie, a full 4 years before they ran out of Bort license plates.
Oh, wow. I haven't played that since the Bort episode, so I never picked it up.
What other amusement park games? I know Universal Studios on GameCube. That's literally it. What are we doing here?
There was a one for Tokyo Disney Sea on the PS2 and Game Boy Advance. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And it came out.
They're thinking of like.
Surely there's a Knott's Berry Farm video game somewhere.
Oh, do they mean like theme park, like or Roller Coaster Tycoon? Surely not.
No, I think they mean a game that tries to recreate the experience of going to the theme park. Honestly, the best theme park video game is Mr. Driller Drillland.
Yeah, that is pretty good, yeah.
No, it's the best, actually.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry, Sharon.
It's okay.
I
just had to keep things straight here.
I always assumed this was based off of Magic Kingdom and Disneyland out in California, because I remember going to Disney World when I was a kid, and they didn't have Autopia or whatever the driving game was. And I was like, well, I was expecting to see that there. What was the deal? But the actual mini game I quite liked. It was something like Bump and Jump. I wish there was more to it. Like that was one of the better mini games. It could use a couple more levels. And the Haunted Mansion of Pirates of the Caribbean was like kind of eh by Capcom standards, but like it was all right. It pulls off that same that trick in the ride where you're facing the mirrors and then they use the projection to say, "Oh, there's a little ghost next to you." And then there's some mirrors you walk past in the game and they reflect your little cowboy dude. And then at one point it changes to a reflection of a little ghost, which was like a cute reference. I was never clear who you were supposed to be playing as. I don't think they ever named you. It's just like you. I would assume you should have been Mickey, but no, Mickey's the one that's telling you to do stuff and admonishes you when you die.
You play as Lydia from Beetlejuice.
Michael Eisner.
It could have used more mini games. The Big Thunder one I thought was bad. Space Mountain was like almost like an early, like a QTE game, basically.
I'm looking at it right now, and because I haven't played this, I'm surprised to see that it's Capcom. And I thought, why wasn't this on the Disney Collection? I remembered it was the Disney Afternoon Collection. This is not Disney Afternoon.
Yeah. You could spend a whole day at Disneyland.
Yeah,
not exactly. Just the afternoon.
It looks kind of cool, I think. Like, maybe it's a good 10-minute kind of game, but it also really looks like Tiny Toon Adventures 2 on the NES, where you're going around Wacky Land, you see. But I assume this predates it by some years.
I think it was 1990, 91, around that era. Like, it's not one of the better Disney games, but it's still has a baseline level quality because it's Capcom.
Yeah, Yeah, exactly. It's hard to believe it would be that bad if it was Capcom, but then again, Strider on the NES.
Yeah, sometimes they missed. I wonder if this game is the like people imprinted on this, and this is why we have Disney adults now.
It's got to be that.
Yeah, it must be. Yeah.
Either that or the insidious kind of capitalist like clause, but you know.
Jeff Vlasic writes, Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves for the NES is the definition of jack of all trades and master of none. Some of you guys are not selling these. I guess you're kind of riffing on Stuart's approach from last episode. This game has practically everything. Overhead sections akin to a lightweight action RPG, an inventory screen, large-scale melee battles, side-scrolling duels with bosses, a section where you outrun soldiers on horseback, and a giant 10-foot skeleton army, enemy. The one thing it does not have, the license to use any of the actors' licenses, evidenced by the silhouette of Kevin Costner on the box and the Nintendo Power cover that shows only Robin Hood's back while he sits on a horse. I do remember that. The gameplay is less consistent than Kevin Costner's English accent, but I have to admit, I still remember it to this day.
I don't know. I think this looks pretty cool. Does it have the Bryan Adams song in chiptune form?
If they didn't pay for Costner's likeness, I'm guessing they didn't pay for that song. Although,
yeah, that stands to
Bryan Adams is Canadian, so maybe they just stole it and thought, yeah, the Canadians won't notice. They're too nice to say anything anyway.
I think this looks extremely Gypcore, and I'm probably going to have to give this a go. Thank you for bringing this to my attention.
Did you say Gypcore?
Gypcore, yeah.
I love that.
I'm trying to make that a thing.
Mm-hmm.
Until now, my favorite Robin Hood game on the NES was Super Robin Hood, which is part of Quattro Adventure, and the Oliver Twins did it, and it's amazing. But this looks kind of cool, actually. It looks like a real mix of genres they've got going on in this. I love the status stream, which is divvied up into like all the different component parts of your guy. It's extremely appealing. I mean, it might be horrible, but I'm going to have to find out.
There was a lot of those European games, like mostly on the Commodore 64 and Amiga, that were like that. They're like, here's five different genres that are vaguely based off the stuff from the Wii. None of them are well done, but here they are.
Yeah, it's got this kind of a top-down, immediate, quasi-Zelda-looking gameplay, but then when you kill someone and you want to loot their corpse, you stand on them, press the A button, go down to search, and then read the text, then go press the A button again and go down to take, and then you take the item off them, and it's like you couldn't have expedited that even slightly. I can think about six ways you could have made that breezier, but whatever. It looks fun.
I do feel like it always gave me the impression of trying to, like, those sections trying to be a little like a very simple Ultima, like RPG, because an RPG is kind of a stretch.
Even like the status menus and things do kind of give that impression. I don't know. I think I'm going to have to play this. This looks dope. I'll report back on this month in Retronauts whether or not I like this.
Okay. Excellent. All right. So this one was developed by Sculptured Software, who I evoked incorrectly earlier, but this time it was them. So there you go. Justin Brown says, the greatest 8-bit licensed game is Star Trek 25th Anniversary on NES because it emulates the spirit of the show instead of forcing it into the constraints of an action game. It opens with a rendition of the intro with developer credits. You can talk to your crew for hints if you're stuck. An injured Kirk is beamed back to the ship without losing progress. When you encounter Romulans in the neutral zone, you'll be attacked every leg of the trip if you're aggressive, or avoid combat altogether if you're diplomatic. The ending dialogue between Kirk, Spock, and Bones is as groan-worthy as the best episode. So that's two for Star Trek 25th Anniversary, neck and neck with Darkwing Duck. Oh, and here we have a second vote for another game. Jordan Vickers here. I feel like I have a really lame answer. Aw. But DuckTales is the best 8-bit licensed game. It has really well-done jumping physics bouncing on your cane, a challenging but fair difficulty, the best type of secrets from hiding items in false walls, and great replay value. It's also one of the few licensed games back then that got an awesome remaster that still looks really good that's sadly stuck on PS3 and 360 consoles.
I mean, not just false walls, but also the even cooler secret, which is going into the goddamn HUD. Like, come on, that's awesome. The status bar at the top, that's not even there, mate. Just climb over it. Brilliant. Love it.
Let's see. From Javier, We have, I don't know if I can sanction this tomfoolery. Hello, Retronauts. Answering this mail call, my weapon of choice is Town and Country surf designs, wood and water range. I consider this game is very colorful, even though it is very rough on the edges, regarding the game mechanics. The character sprites and its motifs are what make this game stick with me, even if I did not own a copy. Kind regards.
I've never played this game, and I was never clear what Town and Country was. Is it like a surf shop?
It was a surf shop that spawned this brand of kind of built around mascot characters. There's like Thrilla Gorilla, and I can't remember who else, but there's like a guy with a tiki mask, and anyway, they surf and they skateboard. And that's it. It's those two events. It's like a really, really cut down California games. It's like half of California games, or a third of it. But the graphics are really good. Like, it looks really nice and the music's good. It's got a nice bopping soundtrack. But it doesn't play any better than California games, and there's no hacky sack, so thumbs down.
The guy in the tiki mask looks a little bit like Strong Bad.
It kind of reminds me of those Jim Woodring cartoon characters that were used as chat room avatars and then adopted for Jerk City.
Yeah.
That's kind of the vibe. Jerk Although City. this game has nothing in common with Jerk City. It's deeply unobscene.
Yeah, not very funny. Although it does look like it has a guy who looks like Scrappy-Doo in a tuxedo who's surfing, which is, you know, kind of cool, I guess. I don't know. Strong Bad and Jerk City in the same segment. Oh boy, what a throwback.
So that's TNC Surf Design from James Cruisling, long you sound. Some of my faves were already mentioned on the pod, but I wanted to shout out one that I hope has gotten a little more love thanks to the Cowabunga collection. That's right, I'm talking about the hilariously titled and incredibly awesome Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 3, The Manhattan Project for the NES. This may have gotten somewhat overlooked in its time due to the fact that Turtle Mania was in its post-prime in 1992. And also a little game called Turtles in Time was out. But I think this game is great, and I remember renting this from my local video store in Cincinnati all the time. The graphics are wonderful. I love that you start out with the turtles vacationing in Key West, and the fighting feels way more solid in this one than the arcade adaptation for whatever reason. Again, there's a lot of competition for the best, but I think this game is wonderful and a great showcase for TMNT.
So hold on. TMNT 3, The Manhattan Project, right?
Mm-hmm.
And TMNT 4 was already out. Turtles in Time.
They didn't call that 4. That was only the Super Nintendo 4.
Yeah, the arcade game was just called Turtles in Time. It was just the second game.
My bad. Yeah. Okay, I got confused by the timeline there. My apologies. I mean, they are traveling in time, so it could have been done.
Yeah, it's kind of like the odd even dichotomy of Star Trek movies, but
right.
Here the even are arcade ports and the odd are original titles.
And no one's going to nominate Fall of the Foot Clan, are they? God damn,
they shouldn't. Wow! I think we might have a winner here. Zarathian's pick: TMNT3, The Manhattan Project. So that's the best game. There's undeniably some late-generation NES quality to this game. The music is excellent, graphics are bright and detailed, the controls are tight, and the inclusion of a throw ability and a unique special attack for every turtle adds some tactical considerations for every stage. But it earns my pick for nostalgia around the initial levels more than anything else. I often played it with a neighbor, and the opening beach ocean stages always invoked vacation vibes every time we booted the game, with those Konami tunes stuck in my head to this day. You get the obligatory surfing stage right after clearing the beach, and hijacking a submarine to catch a ride back to NYC after that is icing on the cake. Fight a variety of foot soldiers and stone warriors across one of Manhattan's collapsing bridges and make it to the island just in time as it ascends into the sky. What a radical intro that encapsulates why TMNT was so cool at the time. Even today, I'll start it up just to play through those first three stages, satisfied after being momentarily transported back to a Saturday morning in the early 90s.
I mean, yeah, we got a front runner now. I mean, unless yeah, we got there's like only, four there's, votes for TNC in a row.
Yeah, there's only like half a dozen more emails. So something's really got to jump in here.
Yeah. Six votes for Prince Valiant. Let's go.
All right. Here's a dark horse. Nooninator says...
I'm publisher of your new book.
That's right. Yes, thanks. The Metroidvania is the best 8-bit license game. License from Jeremy Parrish, because I created the official logo, and I looked at the cover on the book, and Dark Horse actually trademarked the title, so maybe they put a little trademark symbol there, so maybe Dark Horse owns Metroidvania, the word now. I don't know. I don't know how this works. I want to say it's me, but they published the book, so, and they're the ones who stuck the trademark there. I don't know. For me, the greatest 8-bit licensed game has to be one I didn't even play until 10 years ago. Based on an obscure Japanese horror movie, Sweet Home is not only the progenitor of arguably the greatest horror game series, but a great game in its own right. It had some rough edges, sure, but I love the interesting, varied character abilities, spooky atmosphere, cool, creepy graphics, the multiple endings. I had a wonderful time playing this in my mid-30s, and as a 10-year-old horror fan, I'd have been over the moon when this came out in 1989. If only there had been an 8-bit Houssou.
I haven't played this, and I really want to. I know it's got fan translation, and it's as meant, it's the proto-Resi, so I got to give it a go at some point. Either of you played this game? I assume you have definitely played it, Kurt.
Yeah, it's really neat. Like it was at that era where, like, you know, Dragon Quest was super popular, but they were trying to do like weird and interesting things with the RPG template. So they're like, hey, let's have an RPG where you have a bunch of guys, or but there's a couple of girls there too, I think, just roaming around a house, and you have to also solve puzzles with it. It's kind of funny that the movie, like if the game didn't come out, the movie probably would have been largely forgotten. Like, I don't even think, at least the last time that I had written and looked up about this, the movie never even got a DVD release. But it's lived on thanks to this Capcom game, which in turn inspired like one of the big horror video game genres. It's shockingly gory too. It's one of those games that, like, even if they had brought it over, it never would have made it without substantial changes. But there's one character, I think they have a vacuum cleaner. Like, that's their skill. It is a little odd in the way that they have the unique things, but I think it vacuums up glass or something like that.
I mean, that would carry over into Castlevania on DS, where you can get the Persephone stole soul, and you can vacuum enemies to death with the demon maid. She's great. Okay, from Radical Rat. Hey, can you guess what this guy's going to vote for based on that name? Radical Rat. Go ahead.
The Manhattan Project.
You're incorrect, Stewardship. The greatest 8-bit license game for me was the original Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles for the Nintendo Entertainment System.
Oh,
at the time, what?
I love this game.
Oh, okay. That's right, you do. At the time, I really appreciated how open-ended the game felt from the get-go. Being able to do something as simple as choosing whether or not to go into the first sewer you see in the game, or simply skipping it, but having to avoid the cars that could flatten your turtle on the world map made it feel like I had some control of the world the turtles were inhabiting. My favorite part of the game was being able to switch in and out of the turtles on the fly to see which one was best for the current situation. For a 5-year-old, it was just the right amount of complexity for me to have to think about whether I should use a long-ranged weapon holder like Donatello now, or save him for a boss or a tricky situation later on. The game's floaty jumps and glitchy respawns made it an aggravating game at times. But having the freedom to explore a vast world with my favorite turtle buddies made it a game I always went back to, even when I started playing better polished games like Mega Man 2 and Ninja Gaiden.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, like, I realize this is a bit myopic, but I do think this game gets too much hate, though I do also think it is aggravating and it is flawed. I think that it's better than its reputation. I mean, obviously, the Angry Video Game Nerd episode, as funny as it is, contributed to that to some extent. But no, I think there's an element of strategy to this that is still appealing. It's not, in my opinion, until quite near the end that it gets completely unnecessarily difficult. I know that there's like a corridor of RNG that you basically have to hope won't kill you very near the end, because I got very angry with it. But no, I do like this. I think it's cheerful. I think it's sweet. I like this game. It's fun.
I don't know if those are the words I would use to describe that game, cheerful and sweet, but I do think TMNT is pretty good. I liked it enough back in the day to actually power through and finish it.
Wow.
Yeah. The trick is to farm 99 scrolls for every turtle and just blast your way through the Technodrome. Just destroy everything in your path. Just spam that scroll button, and then you get to Shredder and just spam scrolls at him, and you're good to go. But that's the only way to beat it. There's no other way.
I don't think that the dam level is that bad, really. I'm just holding. It's fine. Just change your turtle if you're low on health and get a pizza. It's like, come on, like, what are you doing?
I think if they didn't have the timer there, like, because that stresses everybody out. The minute they see that, they're like, I have like,
that's
what?
Definitely true.
So it's 90 seconds, 2 minutes, or something to get through there.
I think it's 3 minutes.
Yeah, it is just, it feels a lot of pressure. It's yeah, the hitbox is there a little wonky. It's not that bad.
It's not great.
Yeah.
but compared to the RNG corridor, it's not that bad.
I never beat this game. I got up to the Technodrome, the boss. I may have beaten it once and got inside, immediately got thrashed. The Game Grumps recently played it through when we were watching it, and it just strikes me how many rooms have way too many enemies in there. It's like whoever was doing that should have been told, like, just cut it back a little bit, because it just completely overwhelms the NES incredibly. Yeah. It just flicker everywhere. The way the enemies just like come apart and do all sorts of crazy stuff.
I'm still quite tickled by the rooms that are just huge winding circles that lead to like a quarter of a pizza and there's nothing else and you have to go all the way back to get out again. That's why
somebody made a conscious decision to do that, and I'd like to talk to them.
Yeah, but it just feels like the kind of thing where it's like, just don't do it, just notice the trap and just go, I'll just leave. You know,
yeah.
if it sucks, hit the bricks.
Oh,
right?
yeah,
like,
that's right.
You just walk out.
That's what the skeletons say. yeah, you know, there's a room where there's like walls closing in on you and there's a whole pizza and you're like, oh, I need the whole pizza. And if you get it, you will die. There's no way to get that pizza without being killed. So it's the stupidest thing you can do. But impulse control, it's like this game is designed to provoke your intrusive thoughts and not give you enough time to say no, bad thoughts. So yeah, it's really mean, but NES games are kind of like that.
I feel like, and I'm sorry that I keep bringing them up, but like, I feel like nothing crystallizes that specific level of NES frustration as the single gap block that you just walk over, and if you jump, you just fall through it, or you mostly fall through it. Like, that to me was the most James Rolfe ever absolutely nailed it down. Like, you're there with him when that happens. It's perfect. Sorry, I know I talk about James too much. He's my best friend in the whole world, so...
No, I saw you cuddling at that one show. You guys...
Yeah, he's so soft.
Yeah, I mean, we all agree. Yeah, so here's the one from Chris Hill, and wow! This is a surprise combo. The best 8-bit licensed game was Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles for the NES, despite its flaws.
Whoa!
The turtles were hot swappable mid-level, which added an element of strategy to the platforming, and the levels were varied, if unfair, due to programming errors. There's a series of videos by the Displaced Gamer YouTube channel, which I highly recommend, that go into detail about why certain aspects of the game, jumping over small pits, swimming in the dam level, don't feel right, and how changing just a few lines of assembly code fixes them to the point that the game plays much more fairly. This places a lot of blame for its bad reputation on the playtesting and potential development crunch, but in terms of vision, this was head and shoulders above even many non-licensed games.
Mm-hmm. When I was a kid, I always wondered, you know, like, this section is nonsense. Did they even play this game? And then when I grew up and realized, oh, they probably didn't. Like, they tested it just to make sure it functioned and didn't crash. But as far as, like, balancing, like, they just didn't have time. And how many games probably would have been a little better if they just had, you know, another week or two to tune things up?
I wonder if this game would have had a better reputation if this was the one that got you a free pizza. Sweeten the deal, you know?
I think people would have thrown the pizza at the wall in frustration. They would have been, you know, so angry about the dam level.
Throwing it on the roof.
Just that's later. That came years later. Yeah, and true. It involved meth. Yeah, TMNT.
How else are you going to get through it?
Tommy writes, for me, it is the first G.I. Joe NES game. I wonder if this is Tommy Arashikage, a.k.a. Storm Shadow. Wow, makes you think. Each Joe feels different with the weapons they have, whether it is Captain Gridiron shooting a football launcher, or Rock and Roll with a spread gun, or Snake Eyes shooting chi fireballs that take no ammo. The levels get bigger as the game progresses, culminating with letting you play as General Hawk with his jetpack, giving you flight across a huge final level. One of my favorite games, licensed or not, ever. Keep up the great podcast.
That, you nominated that one, didn't you?
I didn't.
Oh, that was the second one you nominated.
Yes. Oh, no. I'm saying. I did mention that last time. I thought you meant like this was me writing an email to
I thought I recognized it from the very long time ago that we recorded.
Yeah, it's been ages.
So distant in the memory. Okay, this is the good one. Atlantis Factor is the bad one. Okay.
Yeah. Atlantis Factor isn't bad. It's the just less why
good
would you
one.
Play it?
The less good one.
No, it's not less okay. good. It's bad.
Oh, okay.
Sorry, I got confused. Jonathan.
No, that's okay. We went through a whole journey there.
Yeah, Jonathan Cade says, Nubo by iRem for Game Boy is an almost impossibly lovable platform adventure in the style of Dizzy, but without the physics or the many, many deaths. It's an easy, breezy, sub-hour-to-complete affair, which is surprising coming from the company that brought us Holy Diver and R-Type. Nevertheless, it is a wholly pleasurable experience with some of the best pixel art and animation you will see on Game Boy, perhaps even surpassing Trip World. Hello. Unfortunately, the titular main character was the mascot of Morinaga's Nubo chocolate dessert line and owned by the Nubo Productions, so the game appears to be in rights hell. I would love to see some enterprising licensee it's directed at me. Navigate the legal jungle and re-release it. But in the meantime, people should play it by any means necessary. There was a nudge, nudge, wink, wink in there. I'm not a licensor. I can't do nothing.
That is Kirby coded. That is really Kirby coded. I'm looking at that right now. I was like, what the hell license is that? And it turns out it's for some candy. So, yeah, that's great. This is what it's all about, alerting me to the existence of things that I might like.
I think this game is really expensive, isn't it?
Not on ROM sites.
Yes, but can you stand to have access to it for only 24 hours?
It looks pretty short. I reckon I can polish it off.
I didn't know this was licensed, but good for it. I mean, in my mind, it sort of crossed with Trip World again. Is a really like cutesy, pretty, but kind of easy, fluffy game.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. The bear cartridge is selling for anywhere from $50 to $120 on eBay right now.
Jeez.
And the boxed game is they're asking $700+ for it. So,
Well, there's an English translation out there. It doesn't cost that much money, and
sounds
it's
like a
technically
good idea.
Be modified. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, there's one that sold back in December for only $400 complete. So it's not that bad.
Okay.
At this point, that's the cost of a vinyl record box set. Tragic. Yeah, Kurt, did you have any thoughts on this besides candy?
I don't remember if I've ever played it. It's another one of those, this looks cool, and then just never did.
Yeah, there were a few of those games based on candy mascots. There was, you know, Bikuriman World, Bikuriman World, which is, you know, just a Wonder Boy game dressed up as those little chocolates that have like a little surprise sticker inside of them. And there was also Kurochan, which is a Castellian adaptation. And it's tied to this chocolate like candy that has a bird mascot. So it was out
that's
there.
That's Castellian.
Yeah, Castellian.
Nebulous.
Yeah.
How many names does this goddamn game have? Okay, that's interesting. Damn, I wish that there was one based on like, oh, James Pond with the penguin bars. There we go.
There's Zool and the Chupa Chups.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
And Freddo 64. That one's made up. Don't worry about that.
And the Skittle GameCube game.
And let's not forget Oddworld and the Sobe. Was that what it's called?
All the games based on M&Ms, Shell Shock, and I don't even know what they're called because I didn't play them because they're about M&Ms. But, you know.
Can you romance the green M&M? That's what the right wingers want.
Oh, wait, in the game, or can I personally?
Yes, because
I
think either.
I could do it. Okay, well, yes, then, with gusto.
Excellent. Well, that's great. So, here is one from Sean Norton. After thinking on it for a while, I think I'd like to cast my vote for Little Nemo, the Dream Master. Even as it predated the release of the film, it was connected to by a few years in North America. Most of the level design is thoughtfully constructed, ignoring the train stage for the moment, requiring to use one animal's abilities, the lizard's wall climbing saw a lot of use, to access a different animal and their skill set so you could reach somewhere else. A blueprint Kirby games would later use quite a bit. It's really just a solid game, and it's a pity it probably won't get reissued like Capcom's Disney catalog has. I wonder about the rights for this one, because Little Nemo... This game was based on a movie, an anime, but the Little Nemo property by Winsor McCay is from like 1901. It's way out of copyright protection. So I feel like Capcom could probably press the issue and make this happen. There's
another Little Nemo game coming.
Yeah, there's a couple too. Actually,
I don't know what it's called. Yeah.
Because it's a
Nightmare Fiends.
It's a public domain property now. Actually, Crazy Cat is probably a public domain property. Someone should make a Crazy Cat game.
Oh, hell yeah, that'd be great. Ignatz, but like when you throw the brick, it's like Yoshi's Island going up and down.
No, I mean, this would have been a great Wii game. Like, use the Wii remote to throw a brick at Crazy.
Like Boom Blocks, except it's Ignatz's face.
Exactly, yes.
Yeah, I'm into this, yeah, for sure.
Sorry, any thoughts there on Little Nemo, Kurt?
It was good. It's weird how like most of the game you just chuck candy at bad guys and only got a real weapon whenever you took one of the animals and then I guess skinned it alive and then wore it skinned to hop around. But at
I
the end of the
think
game,
that's
you
actually
got, like,
what happened.
It's close enough.
Hmm.
At the end, you got like a lollipop that could shoot lasers, which was really cool. The finale of that game. That sticks out the most in my mind because it has really cool music. I seem to recall a lot of spots like Alex Kidd in Miracle World where you had to dive through a lot of spikes or jump on a lot of spikes. That was it's still a Capcom game, so that was in there.
I've only played this the once, and I remember having a sort of train of, no pun intended, of being like, wow, this is really good and really fun, to, wow, this is really hard and I hate it.
Yeah, it's certainly but tougher it, than like a DuckTales.
But it is really cool and clearly like made with love. It just gets super hard, I found.
All right, so here we are at the final email. We did it, everyone. We made it through, and it's actually just the right length for an episode. So thank you to everyone who wrote in exactly the right number of emails. Really appreciate you. Yes, you are the best. All right, from Arn Pauly. At this point, I have beaten dozens of NES games based on licenses. I'll throw down for MC Kids. It's just an excellent, well-made platformer game. I like the momentum-based movement and fun gadgets, like the one that lets you run from floor to ceiling. Banger music, too. It's so good. P.S. The worst I've beaten is Uncanny X-Men. Woof.
Oh.
I don't believe that any human can beat that game. Not necessarily because it's impossible to beat, but just because, like, who could endure that much suffering?
Why would you want to? Exactly, yeah. Now, I'm going to make a extremely non-controversial statement. I think McDonald's have an extremely decent hit rate for video games, and MC Kids is not really an exception. That's a very, very creative game. I mean, I don't really like saying this because in my heart it hurts, but I think it's maybe a little bit too over-designed, but I do like it. It's just fussy. It reminds me of, and I apologize, it reminds me of James Pond 3, where sometimes you're just like, just give me a break, will you? Like, give me a breather. This is really challenging. but no, it's a really cool game. I like the Game Boy version as well. And, you know, I like Treasure Land Adventure and that one Grimace game that they made. That was cool.
Heard about that one.
Yeah.
I don't...
Oh, and Global Gladiators. I like that.
Oh, don't forget the McNugget Tetris.
I'm not familiar with that, but I will be making a beeline for my wallet to purchase a copy immediately.
It's a self-contained, like, you know, handheld unit.
I have seen that. Yes.
It's like a chicken nugget that plays Tetris on it.
Does it, like, smell or taste like... Never mind.
Oh, was that from, like, a Chinese Happy Meal or something like that?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, it's very hard to get. I don't think I ever played MC Kids. I remember looking at the Nintendo Power Strategy Guide and thinking it was really cool because it had these really big Super Mario Brothers 3 type levels. But no, I never got around to playing it.
It's got a lot going on. It's one of those games where it's super fun, I think, but after like three levels, you're just kind of exhausted because of how much it's making you remember like how to interact with. Maybe I'm being unreasonable, but it's super good. It's just a lot. It's so much that I get kind of like, I'm going to play the Treasure one on the Mega Drive again.
All right. So that's it. By your vote, you, the listeners, the greatest licensed 8-bit game of all time was TMNT3, The Manhattan Project. So, not actually that big a surprise. I wouldn't have thought of it, but you know, now that everyone's made their cases and knowing how much this particular cohort of listeners is the right age to have had Turtle Mania bad, I can definitely see it. And you know, yeah. Konami and their 8-bit peak, they were hard to top. A lot of the games here were Capcom or Konami, so it says a lot about what was great. Not a single Sega platform game, so
yeah.
We maybe exhausted it.
I think we ground through all of them last time.
I mean it's my opinion that I'm not trying to do a bit. I think that the actual greatest 8-bit licensed game is Castle of Illusion on the Master System.
Oh, now is your chance. But, okay, you skipped this. Like, so that is, Stuart, go for it.
Well,
wax eloquent.
I think this was on Kurt's list originally. Actually,
it was.
It wasn't on my list because it was on your list, and then you didn't mention it. So I was like, God, yeah. Now everyone thinks I like this shit. No, I'm kidding. No, because I mean, for one thing, yes, I did. It was one of the first games I had, so obviously nostalgia is going to play a part. But I honestly do think that it is the most, like, what, six levels, not one single, like, downer, and just tons and tons of great visuals, music, play controls, superb. It really does feel magical playing it. It's got the kind of 30s cartoon Disney magic, not like today's Disney magic where it sucks ass. The like actual real, yay, Disney, da, 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 that whole thing, you know.
Yeah, it's because they got rid of the vault. That's
like, to this day, the bit when you're basically, there's a level in like a library, and it's just the most, like, everything you could want to do if you were shrunk down in a giant library is there. You know, including there's a bit where you jump on like a teaspoon and like it teleport. It doesn't teleport you. It flips up a sugar cube that lands on the spoon. It acts like a seesaw, springs you up in the air, and you land in the cup of tea. And then there's a bit where you're swimming through the cup of tea, and there's like sentient sugar cubes going up and down. And it's got the most beautiful music in the background, and I feel like I'm going to cry just thinking about it because it's that level of just like, oh, it's diddums. And it's got a badass fight with a dragon at the end, and it's got a friggin' big book that shoots A's and B's at you, which they ripped off for another game, and I can't remember what it was. it's got little letter A's that run around, and when you jump on them, they split into, like, lowercase A's. It's... Oh, God, it's so good. That's all I got. Sorry. Take over. Tag in.
I played the Genesis version when I was a kid, and so it didn't give much thought to the Master System version for a long time. Because they were making games in parallel for a little bit of while while they were still supporting the Master System. And it was really like a hit or miss whether you would get something that was like a whole unique game or just a complete garbage. But this was a whole unique game that was obviously based on the Genesis version. There's a lot of stuff that's pretty similar to it, but it looks different. It plays different. I think there's a lot of individual levels that were in the Genesis version that I think they couldn't fit inside the Master System cart. So they just took what was in there and expanded it, and they did it really well. All the bosses are unique for that version. I think the game itself actually plays a little bit more. It feels like a Capcom game in the way that like you can pick up stuff in the way that the Genesis version really didn't. The dragon was not in the Genesis game. It just had the Snow White sort of witch thing. No, it's
miserable.
Yeah. And then they made like two sequels to this that were like all original.
Land and Legend of Illusion.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. The Mega Drive, sorry, Orma Genesis, I apologize. I'm not trying to be that guy. Mega Drive Castle
of Illusion.
That's
what you called it.
I think it's a good game, but to me, it's almost like that's like got this arcade vibe to it, and the Master System one has an adventure-y kind of vibe to it. It's just creative. There's just all these kind of set pieces that just come in and then they're just gone. They've just got another idea for you. It's and that makes it sound like it's just kind of a situation rush, but it's not. It all feels really cohesive. It's just terrific. And Land of Illusion, I hate to say it, probably better in terms of like what it offers, but it's Castle that's got my heart, you know? Land is a bit too long. Castle, you can just kind of bop through it. It's only got 6 or 7 levels, but they're all great. They're all really, really great. Lots of cool ideas. I'm very fond of the thing in the final stage where it's pitch black, and if you pick up the lanterns, it lights up. But then if you're holding the lantern, you can't then do your general jump attack. So you have to throw the lantern at stuff. But when you throw the lantern, it goes pitch black again. It's just stuff like that that makes me think, wow, they are really smart for having thought of that and implemented it in a non-frustrating way. Yeah, it's great. I love it. Damn, what a game.
Yep.
All right. Video games, everyone. 8-bit video games. Thanks, everyone who wrote in.
Good sometimes.
Thanks, Kurt and Stuart, for weighing in. And I'm glad you finally got that Castle of Illusion there at the end. It worked out.
Thank you. I had to. I'm sorry.
No. I'm glad that was part of the deal.
It's better than Bart versus the Spaceman.
So I thought this was a lot of fun. I'm glad everyone took the time to write in. A lot of diverse opinions, all centering mostly around the NES, but, you know, it was kind of the big thing in the 8-bit days, so understandable. That wraps it up for this episode. We'll be back on Monday with a normal-sized episode. You know how to find Retronauts because this is a bonus episode for patrons only. Thank you once again for your support. You make all of this possible. You bring joy to our days, and we hope we do the same for you. So I'm not going to tell you about the show. I'm not going to pitch it because you know, but I will let everyone give their bona fides and tell you where you can find them on the internet. Yes. So Stuart, please lead.
Oh yeah. You can find me on, I'm called Stuart Jip. So if you just Google that name, you're going to find me mostly. And this one guy who died, but that's not me. I'm on Retronauts mainly. I wrote a book called All Games Are Good, which is available from Learn to Run Games. And do a bunch of other stuff, which you can find on Blue Sky and such. Although on Blue Sky, to be honest, I mostly scream about VTubers lately. So, maybe give that a miss.
All right, Kurt.
And I'm HG101 on Blue Sky at hardcoregaming101.net. Like occasionally on my own, not really my own, it's more the site's podcast, the top 47,858 games of all time, where I know they recently talked about Darkwing Duck, and I'm pretty sure they discussed that Thrilla game, that Town and Country Surfing, whatever.
Well, there's two. The second one is Thrilla's Surfari.
Oh, wow. There's a sequel.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody voted on that one.
Nope. Although I will reveal the exclusive information here that for the past 20 years, when my MacBook is connected to a network, it uses the network name Thrilla's Surfari. So you'll always know how to find my computer on the network. Anyway, for me, you can find me, Jeremy Parrish, at, I think J Parrish on Blue Sky, Jeremy Parrish. Just look for me. I'm out there. I'm not going to pitch anything at you except to tell you that I just published through Dark Horse Comics a book called Metroidvania, The History of Metroidvania, Decade One, which is kind of a prehistory of Metroidvania, really. But it is a book that is literally 20 years in the making. I started blogging about Metroidvania games and abusing the name, the word Metroidvania, 20 years ago, 2006. So it's 10 years of research and writing and lots of time before that. It's a labor of love. Even if you hate the name Metroidvania, too bad, because the games are awesome and you love those. So I'm going to encourage you to pick it up. If you want to pick it up and read it, I'm going to encourage you to go to your local bookstore, even if they don't have it, and ask them to special order it, because enough of that happens, they're going to be like, damn, this book is amazing, and it's going to hit the bestsellers charts. So I need you to be part of that. Game the system with me. That's what it's all about. Metroidvania, gaming the system, cheating. That's correct. Yes. So anyway, that's it for this episode of Retronauts. Thanks again for listening. We'll be back on Monday with a normal-ass episode that you can enjoy. And again, in 2 weeks, with another one of these.